Hello there, and a very good morning to you. And you're very welcome to the programme this morning, and I hope that bit of news from Japan puts a bit of pep in your step. Job done, and we will be talking to Eddie O'Sullivan later on in the programme to tell us how it all went. Now, let's start with the headlines this morning. The Sunday Times, CCTV of bleach purchase to identify Quinn kidnappers, and that may be a very useful breakthrough. The Boris overruled officials over a friend. This is a story about Boris and, as they call her, former model who got various grants while he was Mayor of London, and attacks on public service cards. The Sunday Independent, end the silence on Quinn attack. Minister warns on risk of omerta. CEO, do not abandon us again. And up to 20 men involved in attack. And they also have RTE flies ad executives to Japan for the World Cup. And Brexit leaks warning to the Cabinet. The Sunday Business Post, ODCE launches criminal investigation into doctors' group, and they also have Provost warns Trinity may be forced to cut student numbers and power shortages predicted as demand surges. The Mail on Sunday, we won't kill you. This time, the chilling threat kidnappers made to Quinn executives as further details of his ordeal emerge. And they are horrific details. They're just horrific. The Irish Sunday Mirror, Doc Bam, deadly e-cigs. The Irish Sun on Sunday, our dad's the Irish Fritzel. And Sunday World, chilling. The sinister, death threat letter sent to Quinn chiefs warning they would face a permanent solution. Now, may I introduce our guest to you this morning, John Downing, political correspondent, Irish Independent, former press advisor to the Greens. Declan Power, security analyst. Jean Kelly, partner at LK Shields. Ciarán Mac Award, lecturer in economics and finance with Finther at DCU, and Sheila Riley, head of digital with Iconic News, and I suppose geographically importantly, a cabin woman for this morning. Sheila, you probably better than anybody around this table knows what is going on up in your part of the world.
Well, what indeed. I mean, it's been just an unbelievable week. I think the level of outrage and anguish really over what has happened, Kevin Lunny, is genuine in the areas of Ballyconnell and Derryland. People are absolutely outraged and disgusted that this has happened.
Right.
And I suppose, I think what you're seeing now is a kind of an anger, the focus moving away from nearly the incident, if you like, but also to the fact that this has been a long-standing issue, and why has enough not been done over the years to tackle
it? If I can just interrupt you, on page 4 of the Sunday Business Post, down at the bottom, I would recommend anybody to read it. It goes back to 2011. And the April the 14th, businessman Sean Quinn and his family are locked out of their former businesses and blockades are posted at company quarters in Ballyconnell and Derryland. This all had to do with the crash and the fallout from the crash. But it goes on and on and on. 2012, 2013, 2014, one man receives a death threat on the same day as his wife dies. I mean,
that's right. Yeah, you're looking at a litany of over 70 incidents in the past number of years. Like, there's no doubt about it. It has been, to say ongoing is an understatement. And you see today on the front of the Sunday Times, though, I think there's a kind of a chink of light in John Mooney's piece there, in terms of that they're saying the CCTV footage of somebody buying the bleach has been uncovered, and that this is part of the investigation. And John Mooney alludes to in there's the comprehensive piece inside in the Sunday Times under the title "The Border Bandits." He alludes to the fact that there's believed to be an element of, you know, gangland criminals, organised crime, if you like, criminals involved in this, with tenuous links to republicanism, and that certainly would be the view kind of in the locality, if you like, that there's kind of a criminal element that's been allowed to thrive there in the shadows of the border in the last number of years, particularly in the absence of proper policing in the area, adequate policing, the proper skilled policing required to cover a border area. Like, for example, Ballyconnell Garda Station, which is in the cusp of this area that we were talking about in 2017. So you're after going back there, Marion, and looking at a litany of incidents years back. But in 2017, it was downgraded from a 24-hour station. You know, and it's kind of in the middle of all of this that we were talking about, this area that we're talking about. That will, to my mind, speaks volumes about the level of focus that there has been on this area. And just to finish on that point, are you to go the other side of the border in Newtown Butler and Lisniski in Derry Lynn, you'll be hard pressed to find a PSNI officer on any day of the week. You'd nearly have to go to Enniskillen before you find them. I understand why that is. I understand there are grave security issues for them in covering these areas, but a lot more has to be done in covering this part of the world. In the middle of August, you had a bomb in Wattle Bridge. My near neighbour was out the back garden with her kids when the bomb went off in Wattle Bridge. So you're talking about, this has only happened, what, 3 or 4 weeks ago. Look, we're not talking about years ago. We are talking about this time in Irish history, if you like. This dissident republicanism has been allowed to thrive, as I say again, in kind of the shadows of the border.
By calling it dissident republicanism, is this another word just for gangs of...
It is.
Thugs, mafia style.
I absolutely agree with you. It is. What they are doing is they are using the veil of paramilitaries, if you like, to cover their tracks as they move in and out of the border, over and back across the border, using the border as a background to their activity, as a backdrop against their activity. And using
the fact that... does everybody know, as they say... do the dogs in the street know who these people are?
No, I don't believe the dogs in the street know who's involved in this particular incident, I have to say. But you're talking about, according to some of the papers today, up to 20 people involved in it. So there will be some level, there has to be some level of knowledge locally in terms of who
has
is involved. So, but I don't think that you will be talking about the exact... I don't think the people of Ballyconnell have these guys' numbers on speed dial, to be quite frank. But I do think people do know who've been involved in some of the other incidents over the years. You know, say, for example, you had an incident in the last year where two of the executives, the Quinn executives, had boiling water. One of them had boiling water thrown on them, over them, in broad daylight in Ballyconnell, out getting a cup of coffee. And somebody, another one, Kevin Lunny, had his nose broken in an attack. Like, these things have been happening in broad daylight. People do know who've been involved in this, but why are they not coming out? Like, you know, I've heard a lot of people speaking very forcefully in the last few days about, you know, it's time for people to take a stand. We don't want to go back to this. Brendan Smith spoke about it in the Dáil the other night. Father Jerry Comiskey spoke about it on Drive Time the other day. These are very important points. How do you move away from the rhetoric, though, there, and move to reality? You can't. It's very difficult to do that when people are looking at all that has happened over the last number of years, and they perceive the people involved in this to be untouchable, and they also perceive that the police forces on both sides of the border are unable to deal
right.
with the issue.
Well, it should be said, because it was the former Quinn place that Sean Quinn himself came out this week and said it was barbaric and condemned it, and kind of regretted that everybody comes back to him, but I presume, but clearly there was no love lost between them in there, because they were fighting all the time anyway, I gather. Declan Barr, how do you look at this?
Well, to amplify a point that was made there, I think this is a byproduct of the level of lawlessness and even kind of warped morality that has existed in border areas as a byproduct of the Troubles. And it's a reminder to us in these Brexit times that this has been, this stuff bubbles away beneath the surface, and it takes incidents like this, horrific as they may be, to bring it back onto the Dublin-based radar, and that we need to actually now take steps to get to grips with it. And if I could just break down a few key things that maybe it will help explain further what was being talked about there. For policing in this in Ireland, as in most European countries, is done by consent. It's based on what's known as acceptance-based security. And for that to work, the people, for the most part, have to be fully engaged. That hasn't been the case here, and it hasn't been the case along the border regions, both in the north and the south, for some time. We've dipped in and out of it, and we shouldn't look at this in splendid isolation. There have been other incidents. We remember the death of Detective Garda Éadrín Donoghue in the line of duty, and how that gang were able to use the border as a block to the investigation. There was a young, I think he had been a Republican, beaten to death on a border farm some years ago. There's been a number of incidents. And the big problem that the law enforcement authorities have is that the normal acceptance-based security means is people will come to give information because they accept the rule of law, and they want whatever presence to be maintained because it's of benefit to them. So the locals aren't seeing it from that point of view. The authorities gather intelligence, but that's not actionable to be able to bring things to court. It doesn't translate into evidence. So now, are we at a point where maybe people will be revolted enough to start to be able to give information that can be turned into evidence? There's a few chinks of light, but we can't take this for granted. There were some former colleagues of mine that worked in a consultancy some years ago, 5.5 years ago, that were asked to get involved in providing not just physical security, but surveillance services, a variety of other services, to try and piece together what was happening. Because in these situations, you roll it back to who has the most to gain. And what appears to have happened from that, there have been a number of evolutions. It started off with people in the locality being annoyed at what had happened to the Quins.
Yeah.
And it has evolved beyond that. And it seems to have gotten more sinister and more organised. And definitely, you know, John Mooney's piece is an excellent one in the way it dives into it and poses questions. Mm-hmm. But the hand of dissident Republicans, I would argue, has to be involved in this, because the level of public silence on it, and organised criminals would not dance into this kind of jurisdiction, into the backyard of dissidents, without their say. So,
it is the same as the mafia in Sicily.
Point to this: the level of, it wasn't perfect, but the level of command and control and organisation, as well as the brutality, shows hands at work way beyond just organised criminals that were hired into their job.
Kieran,
this could possibly be a tipping point for the local population. I mean, there's quite a strong march in support of Kevin Lunny during the week. When they realise that there are 830 people employed in Quinn Industrial Holdings, I mean, 830 people in that region, that is a very, very, very significant employer, and there are very limited employment opportunities if anything does happen to Quinn Industrial Holdings.
Well, indeed, and in coverage, I think again it was the Business Post,
yes,
there was talk that if you consider the position of the wives, and I don't know if there are husbands, of the people on that board, like, you'd be saying to yourself, you know, what's the job worth to you? But they have decided, apparently, to act collectively, because they figure if one leaves, the consequences are that these guys will believe they've
won
the
off.
War.
And Richard Curran makes a very good point in the Sunday Independent today, on page 2, the business section. Like, this was bought 5 years ago for about $98 million by the American investors, for less than the net asset value. So there's probably a bit of bitterness there on the Quinn side that they got the assets for less than they cost. But and local management was given a 22% stake, so they're involved. But they've grown turnover by 50% in the very short period since. And kind of the tragedy of this is they were hoping for it to go public at some stage in the near future, but I don't think they'd be able to even consider going for an IPO now after what has happened this week.
I wouldn't have thought
For me, when I was looking at the stories that might be up for discussion on the panel today, and I thought Daryl Lynn might be one of them, my instinct was leave that one so and let other people speak about it, because I know very little about the North. But then when I read this morning Dermot MacDonald's piece, I was sitting in a petrol station earlier and I thought, well, I am actually going to speak on this. It doesn't matter that I don't know so much about the North, but I think that story and this tipping point, I think, is very real. I think this is the rule of law story that's really interesting today. I thought it was going to be public services card or
we'll get
Supreme Court case in the UK. Actually, this is the rule of law story. And Dervil has a fantastic piece on page 19 or so called Time to Fight Back in Fermanagh. And one just line that really jumped out at me, that Mr. Lunny, who she had interviewed last year, I believe, like his children had to run the gauntlet of wanted posters with their father's name on it, as did other board members of QIL, on the way to school. And they had hoped his wife and their six children were resilient enough to deal with the threats. I mean, we are expecting way too much of our kids in Ireland if that's what we're expecting them to put up with. And the other thing...
But I mean, isn't it indicative that those posters were left on?
And remained,
exactly.
And you would know, presumably you would be afraid to take it down. And the other thing that's interesting, although maybe not on a human level so much, but the piece by Aaron Rogan, also on the Business Post on page 4, where he posits the theory that the attacks on Kevin Lunny and the other attacks have been timed to cause maximum disruption to the business.
To the board.
They have been apparently timed so that when the quarterly board minutes of the UK, of the US hedge funds, which now own 80% of the company, happen, that these have to be explained at the board meeting. So these people have not are not just thugs, but they've got an MBA in savagery now. The kind of stuff, the strategic stuff, like we are dealing with a very senior structure of terrorism.
You know, and and that's the kind of, and in fact, that's what the spokesperson, the chair, was saying. We do outrage and we say it is awful, but I mean, for the kids to have to walk.
It has to become an electoral issue, down south, and it will be,
I think.
See,
where it comes back to, and you touched on it yourself, Marion, the idea, you know, mafia and the idea of the omerta, you know, where, you know, the kind of the veil of silence in an area. And I feel in a lot of the coverage there can be a kind of that's misconstrued as loyalty nearly. When that's not loyalty, that is fear and that is anxiety. Look, at in every paper it's referenced the fact that people were afraid to give their names to reporters, even on Vox Pops on radio and that in the last couple of days. Like people were afraid to give their names to reporters. Like people are genuinely fearful of stepping out, of putting their heads above the parapet in this. The community really needs to get mad enough to do that, and that is very, very difficult to do in that atmosphere when you've been living in what I would call nearly an oppressive regime there.
You see, I mean, the trouble is for people in that area, when us in the media go to another circus and the media spotlight goes off that place, what's going to happen? It'll be service. It'll revert to usual service. It was interesting to be in Leinster House when this broke on Wednesday morning, because just as it happened, Drew Harris, the Garda commissioner, who has policing experience by now on both sides of the border, he happened to be answering questions. He was very good. He was very forthright about the whole thing. But later, the following day, Dara Cleary, the deputy leader of Fianna Fáil, was asking, I think quite legitimately, are the authorities generally, leaving aside policing practical difficulties and resources and so on, more generally, are the authorities far too complacent about this issue? And it was notable, we were talking about this before we came into studio, it was notable that the earlier incident where Kevin Lunny had his nose broken, there's somebody north of the border being questioned in relation to that. And that really, we only saw action on that, it's a separate incident, but we only saw action on that being taken later this past week. So there is an element of complacency here on the part of the authorities collectively, both politically and administratively. And it really is time to take the gloves off.
Yeah, and it's not, in terms of how it's been evolving, it's gone beyond normal law enforcement issues. It's a national security issue. If this was an FDI company, if this was an American executive living there that had his nose broken, or their children who had been intimidated, the full weight of the national level assets of An Garda Síochána and indeed PSNI would be put to work. And we should be looking at maybe a joint task force between PSNI and Garda with national level.
That'll go down
a
treat in the Brexit discussions.
It's a reminder to us of the reality of how we need to tackle these things.
Yeah.
With one particular point to bring that national weight to bear, the normal citizenry around those areas, they are justified in wanting to feel their state is there to protect them, and that these thuggish elements can't run riot. When they start to feel that, when they start to see that weight being brought to bear on a consistent basis, then they will be more likely to consider cooperating and giving the information.
Well, I do remember the difficulties that the Gardaí had at one stage in Limerick, and there was talk of it up on another border area again recently. They did solve it and they did resolve
it.
But, I mean, people were living in fear of their lives there too.
But they had to put resources into it.
Yes.
You know, they had to, and what Declan has alluded to there, the concerted, coordinated response is required, and particularly because you are talking about a border situation, you're a land border here, and you've got two police forces. So that means two governments have to decide that they're going to put their money behind this and put their weight behind some sort of initiative to tackle what is happening along that border area there.
Right.
Like somebody described to me in the last week, said that the Clonus Cavan Road is nearly becoming unpoliceable. Like, I mean, that's just absolutely appalling that we'd be talking in terms of that in this day and age. Like, this needs to be tackled, because what is the alternative? The alternative is you are literally handing over an entire region to criminals who think they can run it for their own ends. And basically, I believe money is at the at the root of all of this.
Absolutely.
And all they want to do is line their coffers. There's no ideology here. This is all about money.
Okay. Just to go back, because you are a native of Limerick, has all that gone in Limerick now?
All, by no means.
No.
But the absolute worst of it, and we see it, there's actually some good stuff in the Sunday World today, Dylan. Reminding us, really, in a sense of where we were with it. He has a case of a guy in Castlereagh prison whom we have long forgotten about, who was caught with a mobile phone, one of that whole cabal. But things are vastly better. And it was a symbolic thing, for example, by bringing the Special Criminal Court to sit in Limerick. I think that was a signal also that
of serious intent.
Serious intent, yeah.
Okay, well, the other big story this week was the younger generation going at it with gusto on things to do with climate change. How did you see it, Ciarán?
I think they're fantastic. I think the kids are all right, as the line from in the song goes. I think they're absolutely brilliant. I applaud them. But, you know, at some level, you know, they really need to inform themselves and educate themselves about what's really happening. As I said to my 15-year-old going out the door, I said, you know, I see those runners on your feet. I said, well, how about the foam in them? How about the man-made polymers? And how many years would it take them to degrade if they ever will? And he's kind of looking at me going, here, you know, I'm going out on the climate change march with my mates and it's a beautiful day and we're not going to school. But honestly, like, you know, the materials in a mobile phone, the plastic, the metal, the glass,
and the materials in electric cars.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
I mean,
yes,
people often overlook that.
Yes, and like we really, 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 like, are we serious about this? I mean, it's one thing, you know, the kids go, "Oh, I'm not using single-use plastic straws anymore. I'm using a bamboo straw. Or, you know, the handle of my toothbrush is bamboo and not plastic." Oh, come on, you know, we really, really have to make changes in our own lives to look at what's really happening. I mean, look at the food you're eating. Is there palm oil in the food? I mean, 300 football fields of forest are cleared every hour to grow palm oil trees. Borneo is destroyed. 92% of the rainforest in Borneo is cut down for this single monoculture palm oil. And it's in everything from your favourite chocolate spread
biscuits,
to breads, biscuits, every single thing we eat. You know, educate yourself. You know, the swathes of the Amazon have been cut down for cattle grazing, to grow cattle, for burger meat, for fast food, multinational fast food company. So we need to educate ourselves, you know, really make a difference in our own lives. Marching is all well and good, you know, but is it going to change things?
Yeah, but the fact that this was worldwide,
yes,
and that there was serious intent, even if, as you say, perhaps not 100% informed, there was an awful lot of fear expressed by those youngsters who are afraid, like, that the end of the world is nigh.
Yes, and it's fantastic to see, and their awareness is fantastic. But will they turn around to mum and dad and say, you know, half the journeys, half the car journeys taken in Ireland are less than 3 kilometres. Half them. Like, yeah. Get out of your car and walk, for God's sake. Agriculture and transport account for 80% of the environmental pollution of the damage in Ireland. You know, we can make a difference, but we need, you know, it's all well and good marching. We marched against the Iraq war, against the invasion of Iraq. Some of the biggest demonstrations I've ever been, it happened regardless. We really need to now go and make a difference, because our emissions are growing in Ireland. They're going to go up by 1% in 2020. We're going to miss our 2020 emissions targets by 20%.
How much is that going to cost us?
Sorry
to be crass.
No, you're dead right. This is the thing. So the way we do it is we pay fines to the EU. You know, we don't attack the problem. We don't reduce our carbon output. We pay a fine instead. And, like, can I just look? There's an insert in one of the newspapers today. Little Green Book, sponsored by a car manufacturer. The lead story yesterday in the Times, climate marches. The next two whole pages, a car manufacturer. And it's got claptrap like this, you know. Go salvage hunting. You know, be a rock star. You know, use terrazzo tiles. You know, change your web browser. I mean, come on, lads. Okay. Come on. There are ways that you can do it.
Well, I better defend home trade a little bit here.
Actually,
I
didn't mention the newspaper, John.
It's in the Sunday Independent. It was also in the Irish Independent yesterday, this little book. Look, it's very easy to have pot shots and to be, you know, to disparage these things. But I think people are asking, what can I do on a practical level? And there's 50 suggestions. And I think it's small stuff.
Is there a bamboo toothbrush?
I think so, yes. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty predictable. Plant trees, grow your own veg, all this sort of stuff. All right, it's very easy to sneer and dismiss it. But apart from anything else, if it's of practical value, may at times be questionable. But it does engage people, and it does alert people, and it does involve them.
I'm not sneering, not at all. I'm not belittling it, not at all. But we are not serious in this country. We're the 19th in Europe in terms of CO2 emissions. We're the second last in the whole of Europe in terms of generating electricity from renewable sources. Mm. Malta are the only ones below us.
We haven't increased the carbon tax since
2010. We're one of the richest countries in the world. And we're pumping raw sewage from 86,000 people into our water. Ways in this country. I mean, are we? You know, we are. We've got the highest growth rate of any economy in Europe for 5 years in succession, and we haven't tackled the issue of
but well, there are many other issues.
Just on this, I think there's a couple of interesting angles. First of all, I think I certainly noticed over the last few days, people, you know, these kids are not marching on their own. There's an awful lot of parents marching with their children. And I saw one poster that was on photograph one of the papers in recent days, a kid holding up a sign saying, "We vote next." And I think we'd all do well to remember that. These children are, in some of them, only 4 or 5 years away from voting, including your guy with the foam runners. So by the time the next European Parliament election come around, and I think it's 2024, thousands of those children who are on the street on Friday are going to be voting. And they are unusually politically engaged, and they are absolutely actively involved in people's purchasing decisions, including, one hopes, you know, holidays, car types, journey choices. I think you are going to see a shift. We've already seen a shift in relation to people's
habits on that. It's government policy now, they say, to have us all going around in electric cars by 2030.
Yeah.
But you hear other people talking about the manufacture of these cars and the incredible...
In the round, it's still better.
But we need to build cycling infrastructure. We need to encourage kids walking to school. I mean, the school run...
You're talking about behavioural change.
Yes.
Your attention to one of the lead stories in the Sunday Times on the front page, majority choke over doubling of carbon tax. And it's a story by Justine McCarthy. And this was on a tax on petrol, diesel, coal and briquettes. 72% of respondents said they would not.
And I think that's, you're at the nub of it, because until people start to realise that this is going to impact on your pocket and your lifestyle and your way of life, but are you going to be prepared to change it for the greater good? Now, we have seen glimmers of light before. We never thought the smoking ban would take the way it did, or the plastic bag ban, and that required people to voluntarily...
Or the dirty coal.
Indeed. Yeah. And we made efforts to change because we thought of the long-term issue. Now, it requires government and society to help us.
Well, there was meal murder. I remember when Mary Harney was trying to get rid of the coal.
Yeah, and the industry were lobbying against it.
They ran into programmes in their droves. Mm. This has destroyed the grate. We can't get any heat. Yeah. It isn't as hot as the other coal. And endless complaints.
And yet,
about
in many ways, it was seen as a no-brainer because of the quality of life issues that improved. Mm. And people, there are people alive today because of that ban. Coming back to something, a colleague of John's, Dan O'Brien in the Sundindo, he's written nearly a blueprint in terms of to remind us if we want to change this, it'll be down to new technology and taxes, and that could save the planet. And that's what those people with the foam runners and whatever else who are going to be voting, and I applaud their political awareness, but they're going to be the ball carriers now in the future, that they realise it won't be bamboo toothbrushes, it'll be carbon taxes, it'll be less flights, it'll be changing our whole view on life.
But we need to avoid a gilets jaunes situation in France, because carbon taxes will hit rural dwellers more than they will.
When you're talking about 3 kilometre, most journeys, 3 kilometres to school, like where I live, there's no cycle path. The only option literally is a car journey.
They're not in the cities either, though, Sheila.
Yeah, well, I understand that. I think the most positive aspect out of it, there's been a lot of dismissed coverage in terms of, because of the age group of the people involved, because they are young people, what we are seeing is the mobilisation of a generation into civic activism. Mm. And I think that is the most important aspect of the whole campaign, to be quite honest, that these young people are mobilised and they're vocal, and hopefully they will come out and make a better job than their generations before them have of this issue, and not only this issue but also other issues as well,
right,
that they will become engaged at a different level, younger, more vocal and more active,
politicised
and taking part and putting themselves forward for election.
Absolutely.
That's what you want to see.
That's worked in the Vietnam War. I mean it took a long time. Mm. And that was kind of right across the board. It affected middle class, blue collar, the whole, except of course for George Bush, Bill Clinton, Donald Trump.
Bone spurs, I think, wasn't it? He couldn't be drafted because of bone spurs.
And they're brilliant kids. I mean, I cannot understand. Greta Thunberg, she's a fantastic young woman. The level of abuse she's getting online and on social media from grown men and women, I don't get it. Like, she, you know, she's doing something for the greater good, for the planet. She's never going to fly again. And yet...
She seems to particularly annoy grown men. Yes. I don't really understand why that is. But
I actually read her statement
to US Congress there last night. And I confess all I knew about her was, you know, that photograph, that iconic photograph of her sitting outside the Swedish Parliament for all those Fridays on her own, and those kind of juxtaposed with the thousands of people in the recent march. And those are very moving pictures when you see them kind of starting to juxtapose the person on their own versus the crowds. And so I decided to have a look at her statement to the Congress, and she's actually an extraordinary writer, which I hadn't realised. I mean, it's a really angry piece, and it's a really well written piece. It's an extraordinary piece for a 16-year-old to have written. And I agree, I mean, she's getting a lot of abuse on social media. Well, essentially she was saying just rally behind the science, and that she didn't want platitudes and didn't want people saying that she was a great girl or whatever the Swedish equivalent of that expression would be for all that she was doing, but that she wanted actual action. And it's a very kind of thumping kind of piece, and it's very well written. The other certainly thing that I noticed, just even among my friends, just observing, I was stuck in an airport on Friday evening and delayed, and scrolling through social media, I saw a lot of my friends with their very real pride in their kids' involvement in this. And one of my friends' daughter, Isabel, who's probably listening, hi Isabel, photographed in front of the Irish Times with her own placard. You know, these are really kids who are going to be politically engaged
in
the future.
It sounds like,
you know,
it.
It's always
and
going to be a part
vote.
Of their makeup. They will vote this way. And I saw Renew had a tweet yesterday. I actually I thought the tweet was so strange that I thought Renew had actually been hacked. So, but Renew had a tweet basically complaining that the march, and sorry if they were hacked and it wasn't them, then I'm sorry. But the Renew tweet said something along the lines of, this climate march has just been, you know, a recruitment exercise for the Green Party. Now, when I thought Renew would want to, of all political parties, would want to be aware of the dangers of extinction. But, you know, that was an extraordinary piece.
And extinction is to come.
Extinction is kind of heading their way. But, you know, that was a particularly tone-deaf type of statement to be making in the context of people's pride and in their kids' political activism, which is to be welcomed. Okay.
Speaking just on the point of tone-deafness, going back to Thunberg's strengths, I think the fact that when she has the platform that she's not letting her ego drive it, she's saying, look at the science. I thought that was remarkably mature. Yeah. Secondly, at first I kind of was a bit dismissive of her idea of travelling the Atlantic in a sailboat, but actually
it did have the slight touch of the stunt about it.
It did, and it seemed kind of out of touch with reality. But then I thought, actually, she's pointed to the fact that we have to realign our thinking. We have this thing, it's like social media, mobile phones, and the way we use aircraft, we have to be there tomorrow. We're being asked to actually realign our thinking. How soon do you need to be there? Can you take a train, take a ferry to get to that meeting? That's what she's challenging.
I see Bertie Ahern calling for large craft.
Interesting in itself, because it's an example of somebody talking about positive stuff that we can do to fight. He's talking about it in the context of Brexit.
Yes.
And that
we
go direct.
Have the land. Yeah.
And we go direct to mainland Europe. And I think that's an excellent idea.
Right. Is this the Greens' time to bloom, if I may put it that way?
I think, yes, they're very much back in public view and the public mind. And, they're to some degree on a high, which may not entirely last. But I think it is more durable in the medium to longer term, and I think they have stood their ground on this issue. And, they will certainly...
And their leader has just remained dogged.
Yeah, yeah, he has unapologetically stayed with this.
Yeah.
And I think we could see them with anything up to 10 Dáil seats in the next election. That's a chunk of political trade,
The only thing is that the larger parties will try and jump in and steal their clone.
Of course.
This is the really strange thing, because after they did so well in the European elections, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael came out and they were all green all of a sudden.
Yeah.
But in the last budget, it was really, really disappointing that the carbon tax was not increased from 20 euros per tonne to 30 euros per tonne. Yeah. And it was so strange, because the groundwork had all been prepared. You know, everyone was expecting an increase in the carbon tax, and then it was pulled at the last minute, possibly because of some of the rural-based independent TDs.
And I think, a thing that's going on, and it's not often enough stated, is that diesel is the beating heart of rural Ireland. Mm. And there is this competition between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, and Fianna Fáil never miss an opportunity to try to argue that Fine Gael are not listening, that they're a bit indifferent to rural Ireland. Mm. So,
Well, of course, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael would say that they've been pushing green issues since God was a child, and that they're deeply committed to it. Though I thought it was interesting to read today that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are not going to challenge for the Shannon seat that went to Europe and let the Greens kind of inherit it. That surprise you?
I think it's time to be, both of them realise it's time to be nice to the Greens,
For Aragla and Hoglis.
What's coming at the next
election?
The elaborate
courtship has begun in terms of the election.
A couple of callers. Marion, get your panel to cop on. Why is your panelist slagging off the young people's protest? He said himself he wasn't slagging them off, but he was advising all of us to think about how we have to change and think big. Another one said, one of your guests stated that bread contained palm oil. This is misleading, as palm oil is not added, and most bakers are aware of this and act responsibly. Incoming president of the Irish Bakers Association, Tony Kane. Marion, the children are not in it for the day off. They're striking for political action so they can have a future. They won't be able to purchase too many sustainable trainers in a system that doesn't demand it. The kids are all right. Another said, will these young people get up in the mornings and walk to school? Also, could their parents get rid of their big cars? Well, walking to school seems a fairly obvious one on so many levels, depending, again, rural, urban, distance, and all of that kind of thing. Listen, I'm going to take a break here. With us in studio this morning, Sheila Riley, Ciarán McWard, Jean Kelly, Declan Power and John Downing. Back after this.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Tesco, where even the little things make all the difference. Tesco, every little helps.
Welcome back to the programme. Well, now, we started off with what's going on up in Derry Lynn and on the border up there. But we're now going to take a trip over to Uachtaráin, and there's a particular account in the Sunday World. It's a double page, page 18 and 19. A town called Malice, which sounds pretty harsh, but it has pretty harsh things to tell us, John Downey.
Yeah, it raises questions, particularly about the family living close to the hotel, and generally a certain groupthink and a certain modicum of hysteria, I suppose.
Tell us what's going on.
Just hold on one sec. It's a piece by Nicola Tallant, where she talks about the ugliness. Public roadway to the 70-year-old John Nolan, who's the former owner of this hotel. Last weekend, more than 1,500 people marched through Uachtaráin to protest against the decision to house asylum seekers in the hotel. Then she talks about Noel Grealish. And generally, she talks about getting what we'd say a very short shrift, really, from many of the local people when she wanted to discuss the issue. She talks to John Nolan. He says, the fact of the matter is that if the hotel does become a direct provision centre, I have no problem living beside it. Why no problem living beside it? Why would I? The hotel has played host to people from all over the world for 50 years. He cites all the various nationalities. What's so very different now?
Yeah, but wasn't there also an account in it where the light was shone into people who were associated with it, into their houses at night, and the daughter's car surrounded by a group of people in an intimidatory fashion?
Yes, and then she talks, in fairness to the people of Uachtaráin, she talks about the poor communication, and they see just changes happening at the hotel, and they begin to ask themselves, what's going on?
Right.
If you go to the Mail on Sunday, you find Ger Colleran writing, saying, well, sniggering at the locals who raise legitimate fears about these direct provision centres isn't going to help anyone either. And interesting, a sort of defensive interview from the Cork South West Independent TD Michael Collins, who was cited making disparaging remarks about asylum seekers, insisting he's not racist, and interestingly saying he would favour better conditions for asylum seekers and more money for people trying to live on direct provision. And in the Sunday Independent, Dr. Liam Weeks is writing about an interesting piece about how we're uncomfortable when we don't really like to publicly discuss these things, and we don't want our politicians to express our views which we hold silently and secretly. Yeah.
And I mean, people protesting also say that they object to the whole direct provision.
Well, it is an interesting sidebar to this debate, yeah, because of the inequities of direct provision.
Well, one of the things that people complain about is that the Department of Justice, or the relevant department, doesn't talk to the community beforehand. And you have to have a sneaking suspicion that they don't talk to the communities beforehand because they're
afraid.
Which
would never get off the ground at all.
I understand that, but I think what you're saying, time and time again, we see this coming up. And what people feel is that, because I've seen the exact same thing happen in Rooski, and certainly don't condone what went on in Rooski then subsequently. But what you see is that people feel that this has been foisted upon them in the middle of the night nearly, and that there's nobody to talk to and there's nobody kind of giving them any information. And in that vacuum, my God, do people come in from all places to kind of fill their fears, if you like, and fuel their fears with nonsense, to be honest. And it just ends up kind of taking a life of its own. I saw it in Rooski and it was absolutely frightening the way it just developed out of hand, and that people who had legitimate concerns in the community about a direct provision centre opening up in a village on the Roscommon Longford border, yet they were right to be asking questions about it. And I totally understand where the people of Uachtaráin are coming from as well, in a village of 1,300 people, and they are being told that this centre could house up to 250 people. So let's, you know, put that in terms of the population. Like, there's 1.3 million people living in Dublin. You know, do the sums. You'd be talking about 250,000 people come in. No, you know, like, people would stand up and start to ask questions. So, but what's happening is that those questions have been turned against people and making them out to be racist. And the reality is they're asking, which I would certainly feel are legitimate questions for their community, and they're not being answered. And the department has many questions to answer here. They should be landing down into these areas, setting up their stall and taking all comers, answering all questions.
But
honestly,
you know that if they do that, people will come out of the woodwork and object.
Yes, they
and
will,
what
Marianne.
Do you know do now with your asylum?
I know they will. Well, first of all, I would absolutely oppose the direct provision system. It is absolutely inhumane and ridiculous. There's no way people should be left in that system for so long. It is totally and utterly immoral and wrong. So that's the first thing. But the second thing is, people will object. They will, of course. But at least if you're standing in front of them and answering the questions, what's happening is there are people who I would call nefarious individuals coming from all over. They're answering the questions for them. And they're telling them basically lies. And they're absolutely, I go back to the idea of fueling their fears and filling them with just information that is totally and utterly wrong. And in this vacuum, you build up this whole community that literally then begins to live on the edge of hysteria for no reason. And it's totally and utterly unfair. This, to my mind, comes back to the department, to be
Sheila,
honest.
Sheila, there's even less lack of planning, and that builds up resentment on both sides. So you're foisting, say, in Rooski, for example, 100 people in. There's no language supports. Are there enough GPs to deal with them? Is there a private healthcare centre? Have you public transport to bring them to the centres of Carrick and Shannon and Longford? Are there schools in the area? I mean, you're foisting 100 people in and you've got no supports. Yeah. And this, for me, is the issue. But yet, if you raise any question at all, you're branded with one label or another. It's just a lack of planning, and you got resentment on both sides. Then they don't want to be there and the locals don't want them there.
And Marianne, if I could go back to the point you're making, it's a rather pessimistic premise that you're issuing out there, that everybody would come along to object. Let's go back to what Sheila was saying. You would get people if the central government started to engage with the communities and do the groundwork. There's a process to this. This gets done in other parts of the world. It gets done in towns around the country where the county councils have to engage in new road building or whatever else. And you will have a bit of fractiousness. And then eventually there's some sort of consensus and things get done. And you would allow people come out of the woodwork that would have sensible suggestions and that the central government people might not have thought of. And you would build a consensus. And if the people have been given some skill set that are coming down and awareness of who they're dealing with, this can and should and has done in other jurisdictions, worked.
Right.
And I think that's the only way forward. Rather than foisting it, and then there's negativity, as Kieran said, being bred everywhere. And then you have these artificial battle lines because you have the sort of social justice warriors coming in looking for villains. You have these extreme right-wing strange characters coming in to stoke the embers, and the struggle becomes something different, and it's taken out of the hands of the locals.
Right.
And that's what happened in Rooski.
Just to amplify something that Sheila said there, I mean, I think part of the issue is, I mean, you know, I think most reasonable people would object to the direct provision system, and particularly the length of time that people are in it. So I think part of the issue
we're wearing your legal hat. why in the name of all that is holy and wonderful does it take so long to put people through?
That the state often battles people's applications for asylum and does so in a quite inefficient manner, and that's no criticism of the individuals involved. They're not resourced in a manner that's appropriate. I think a big problem in all of this area is that, because it's so new, we see it as a new public service. We've always had Department of Health. We've always had, social welfare. This is a core public service that goes along with being a wealthy country that's a member of the UN. We are signatories to international conventions. We are obligated under national law to our international law to resource these things. And what we are trying to do is, you know, run it by direct provision centres and let people, you know, fester in these, you know, very not fit for purpose buildings a lot of the time for 4, 5, 6, 7 years.
Yeah. And longer.
And longer. Children are doing their homework on closed toilets in these centres. And actually the first generation of children are actually now doing their leaving search.
This was a temporary solution brought in 1999 by John O'Donoghue as Minister for Justice.
So I think, I mean, there needs to be a mindset set shift to this needs to be properly resourced. This is a core public service, and we either do it well or we throw our hat at it. But if we do it in the way that we have been doing it of late, we are just going to stoke up these vacuums which are absorbed then by people coming in who are racist or whatever else, and who stir up
and yet you hear report and report where they are, where these places are now, that there has been a partnership developed very well with the local community.
Yes. Yep.
But, I mean, things like language support and all that are so essential. Yes. How can you teach a child if the child doesn't understand a word
you're
saying?
And how can you treat them for medical conditions?
Just on two other practical things that I'm reminded of there as I'm listening to Jane. One is, the reason it takes such a long time in a lot of the cases is these people are coming from fractured locations, fragile states that have gone beyond fragility. They're completely chaotic. Mm. So you have the state services here trying to establish, we'll say, who is Jean Kelly if she arrives here? How does she qualify for refugee status? And they've got nothing on the other end to work off. So that takes time, and we have to be aware of that. So sticking these people into a direct provision centre as if they're nearly a security threat, and not taking into account that most of these people have qualifications, trades, and are willing to work. And we could harness
really
their
energy.
Really want to work. In fact, I can remember one man being brought before the courts back nearly 20 years ago. He was he had been a lecturer in philosophy in his home country, and he was sick and tired and bored, and he felt his family's honour was impugned that he couldn't work. He went and got a job with a foreign multinational and ended up their manager of marketing, and he actually tried to stop his payments, and he was told, oh, you can't do that, that's against the law, you can't be, you know. And he thought, right, okay, so I'll say nothing. And he just got on with it, and eventually he was brought before the courts for defrauding the state. And he said, I willingly give back the money. He said, I want to work. Let me work. I pay taxes. So, you know, why don't we let these people do it? They can still be monitored.
Right. Okay, listen, I'm going to have to take the break for the 12 o'clock news. Back after this.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Tesco Club Card. Helping you save more every time you shop. Tesco. Every little helps.
Welcome back to the programme. Now, with reference to the story on the front of the Sunday Independent about RTE, I have this statement issued today. The commercial client visit to the Rugby World Cup was on a cost-neutral basis, made possible by contra deals. Licence fee income was not used. RTE must generate commercial revenue to fund public service output. This trip was undertaken to support vital commercial relationships, which allow us to maximise commercial income. So that was from today, Sunday the 22nd of September. Now, we've been joined in studio by Ireland's former United Nations Ambassador on the Security Council way back in 1981, Noel Doerr. You're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
And we'll be talking about the UN and what we're trying to do there fairly shortly, but we haven't come to our very good friend Brexit yet in the programme. I'm going to go to you, Sheila, on an article in the Business Post looking to try something, DUP looking to try something different on backstop and pass.
Yeah, this is a piece by, a very good piece by Michael Brennan in the Business Post today, and it kind of looks at where the DUP is now, you know. And I think it makes a number of really important points, and particularly, you know, we heard much talk this week about, you know, their newfound flexibility, if you like, which I think most of us would take with a grain of salt. And he's making the point that really this is kind of motivated, if you like, by the stance that Trade and I, that the businesses within Northern Ireland have taken, the business groups have taken, that they have kind of been so vocal on the fact that they will not support a no-deal Brexit, and that how disastrous a no-deal Brexit is going to be for the entire business community, and indeed for people in Northern Ireland.
How deep does that go?
Well, I mean, at the Centre for Cross-Border Studies, they had a conference in Dundalk the other day, and the most senior Northern Ireland civil servant spoke at that. I think his name is David Shedlin, and maybe somebody might correct me in terms of that. But he outlined that economic output over a 10-year period could drop 9% in Northern Ireland in the next 10 years as a result of Brexit. He spoke about the threat to possibly, you know, how 40,000 jobs could be affected by in companies that are exporting in Northern Ireland. And he talked about the potential damage that could be done to the farming industry as well up there. I mean, I think we don't really, or haven't really taken on board just how devastating that could be for Northern Ireland.
But
at a time, Northern Ireland has never made the economic progress that we have made down the south, and we well know this. In many ways, we've handed them the peace process and said, there you are now, isn't that well and good enough for you? And yet there's a whole generation of people coming along in the north who are growing up in poverty, who don't have the same level of educational attainment that we have in the south. Susan McKay, speaking at that conference the other day, made the point that 2 out of 3 children who are born in the Craigan in Derry are born into poverty. That is absolutely shameful.
But can I come back to the DUP? Because there is a natural affinity between the south and the nationalist side, simple as, without giving enough respect always to how important their identity is to unionists, from extreme unionists to moderate unionists.
Well, I think that nobody has done unionism a greater disservice, to be quite honest, than the DUP in their actions in the last number of years, and how they have carried themselves, if you like, in the Parliament there. And they have really they've allowed this to go, if you like. They allow this, the backstop, to become the central issue, because they never actually probably believed, and this is touched in the article today, in Michael Brennan's article, they probably never believed it would come to this cliff edge.
Because it would be defeated.
They probably didn't think that. And indeed, Michael Brennan quotes from Paul Nolan there, who he says is an independent researcher, and he makes the point that Brexit was never a focus for the DUP, really, until after the referendum, and then all of a sudden they became the kingmakers, and they were being courted, of course,
naturally,
by the Brexiteers over there, and that is politics. And it's now, and here's politics coming into play again. It's now when they are out, of course, when the Parliament has been prorogued, so they are obviously out of their king-making position for now. One never knows, of course, in politics how things will revert back. But now that they're out and they're looking, you know, in the cusp of an election,
but they couldn't do a U-turn.
Well, they can't, but they can. It's, you know, ultimately, it's
language.
Politics. It's all about the language that you see used.
So I think Arlene Foster is coming under severe pressure from the business community in Northern Ireland and the PSNI, who are saying to her, look here, this could have serious implications for us. So she referenced at the Dublin Chamber dinner on Wednesday night, she referenced a special geographic position. And she said that we could come to an arrangement, an economic arrangement with the South. Backstop was not mentioned. The word backstop wasn't mentioned, but it was clear that there was room for shifting. And the EU hasn't quite said it, but there was talks mooted that it could be kind of, if it was done through Stormont, it could be okayed by the European Union. Now, this gives Boris Johnson a very, very, very good excuse. You see, Boris has promised Brexit by October 31st.
Yep.
And if he can get the DUP on side, if he can get them on side through a special economic arrangement without mentioning the word backstop, language is all important in this, you see.
Right.
Language is all important. It's important that nobody is seen to have won or gotten one up on the other.
Right.
So Boris still gets his Brexit by October 31st. DUP are on side. But we must remember, Boris doesn't have a majority in the House of Parliament. He'll have the DUP, and
the May deal is the only deal that the EU are going to agree with. So that's the deal that'll have to get through.
Yeah, Noel Doerr, on that, given your background in diplomacy, I know that politicians do U-turns all the time, but I believe that the DUP figure that we in the South do not understand their sense of identity and don't take it seriously.
I think you're right. We do need to take that seriously, not just the DUP, but the unionist community generally.
Yeah.
But I think we talk a lot about the trade aspects and cross-border trade and so on. But deeper than that, it seems to me, in this issue, is the question of identities. In the Good Friday Agreement, the key thing for me was you could be British or Irish or both. So there was an ease about the old conflict of identity in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
And that was worked out in practice by a soft border, human contacts, ambulances crossing schools, all sorts of things.
Yeah.
So that's
normal life.
But underlying it, of course, the unionists need to be reassured. And they do have the reassurance of the referenda, including the writing into our constitution of a new requirement that there could only be unity if there were agreement north and south. So I think that my guess is what might happen, and it's only a guess because I have no inside information, is that Boris Johnson is trying to shepherd and hold what he wants to produce until, say, mid-October, so that it won't be gnawed at or, if you like, frittered away in various arguments before then. He'll probably produce something a bit like, very close to the Northern Ireland-only backstop, but there will have to be adjustments to it. And then the question for us will come up at that time, are we prepared to accept those adjustments? Because I can't see any other way that he can get out of his dilemma where he has said he won't look for an extension. And at the same time, it says
his
that he won't break the law.
Told him to.
So it seems to me he's going to produce something out of a hat at some time in mid-October. The EU is pretty impatient at the moment because they're being seen in the British papers that there's progress being made and so on, and they know the reality on the ground is very, very far from that. But I think what's happening is the British government is holding itself in reserve until the right time. It will probably focus again on a Northern Ireland only backstop, but it will have
different
some modifications
language.
And it will certainly need reassurance to the unionists. But I think there are signs there from Arlene Foster and indeed even from Boris Johnson himself that there's going to be movement. So that would be my guess, but it's just a guess.
Right. One of the things, Jean, you want to talk about is the court case in Britain.
Yeah.
And your assessment on it. I mean, the coverage on it is not huge today, but there is some.
Yeah, there's a couple of pieces I think that are worth looking at. One is Francis Gibbs' piece in the Sunday Times, and the headline on that is, "You take the first swing, my learned friend, I'll strike next." And I mean, this is a particular complication to Boris Johnson's life, which probably doesn't need any more complication in the next 6 weeks than it already has. But the UK Supreme Court has had 3 days of hearings last week in relation to the legality or otherwise of the decision to prorogue Parliament. And as Francis Gibbs' piece would say, most times proceedings of Supreme Courts are dry as dust to watch. They don't get a huge amount of viewers.
Yeah.
Typically in the UK Supreme Court's live stream gets no more than 20,000 views in an average month. It got 4.4 million views last Wednesday when the hearings started. Now, I'm not a litigator, so all of this stuff is kind of as new to me as it is to anyone else at the table, but it was absolutely fascinating to watch. You saw Lord Panic become this kind of very unlikely legal pin-up, and I know it's a niche, it's a bad day for a nominative determinism because Panic is his name and he's certainly one of the calmest individuals you would ever see. But anyway, 4.5 million viewers watching it. I think one of the interesting things about it is the level of public engagement with it. There was something on Twitter during the week that a Dublin hotel screen, which would normally have Sky News on the two TV screens in reception, had on the left-hand screen live feed to the UK Supreme Court's page, and on the right hand side a Twitter stream of commentary on the advocate submissions, which is, you know, for anyone involved in the law, it's really heartening to see that level of engagement. I think what's very interesting about Thursday and Friday is that a lot of the question, and I was only following it like after work at night looking at the highlights reel, you know, was that the level of questioning from the Supreme Court in the last 2 days were all about the remedies, and they were asking the UK government, what do we do? What do you want us to do, essentially, if we fine for Gina Miller? That was essentially what the questions were. So a lot of commentators, and there's a piece in The Guardian by Jamie Doward, which is worth reading, a lot of commentators are of the view that the Supreme Court might be poised to rule against Boris Johnson, in which case, if he loses that case next week, which may be a finding by a Supreme Court that he has misled the Queen, to boil it down, it will be very difficult for his position to be maintained next week if that happens. Now, the decision is coming out either Monday or Tuesday, but that could be, to use the very dramatic language of The Guardian, a constitutional eruption of volcanic proportions. So that's going to be fascinating.
But you get the feeling that no matter what happens or no matter what the judgment will be, and that'll be up to the learned colleagues to do, that Boris Johnson feels he's immune and he can walk on water. He doesn't.
He may do a second prorogation if that happens. So we might be. This might just continue and run on and on, you know.
What you have in the whole Brexit issue for 3 years is a tension between two concepts of sovereignty. Historically, the British concept of sovereignty for the past four centuries was that it was the Crown in Parliament. Then you suddenly go to a referendum. The first was 1975 under Harold Wilson, and this is the third referendum. So you're invoking the sovereignty of the people, which we have in our constitution, but the British didn't
have.
Yeah. So you have that tension. And Boris Johnson, even if the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court is really adjudicating on the distribution of powers between the different elements, the government, the parliament, and indeed the court and the people. So it's a very interesting, and I agree it was a most interesting thing to watch. I was fascinated by it, all the issues being argued about. But if you raise the possibility that Boris Johnson's case would be lost, so to speak, and what would he do? He might, in that case, still hold to the sovereignty of the people, as expressed in the referendum, as against the Parliament. I don't think he could get away with that too easily. But I thought first that the court would definitely say it's not our business, it's political.
Yes,
but
I thought
so
too.
The more you listen to it, I know you can't always, in a court case, the judge often asks the questions against the position that he or she is about to take just to test it. But more and more,
as the
week went on, the questions seemed to be. The one who fascinated me was the counsel for the Welsh government. I thought he was fantastic, but he was the man who had written a book about judicial review, so he was absolutely fantastic.
As they say here, happy out.
I'm sorry to say I've had some regret that the Northern Ireland representative, Queen's Counsel, I think Lavery is the name, was called to order several times by the court because he was talking more about Brexit and they wanted to keep it to the net question and not to get into Brexit.
Right.
There was a great moment on Thursday where John Major gave evidence and, a thing that I'd forgotten about John Major is that his family background was his parents were in the music hall industry or whatever. Right, yeah. But he had this quote, which, you know, is probably, you know, the quote of his lifetime. I jotted down before I came in, and he was talking about Brexit, and he said, as someone who escaped the lurid treadmill of life in a circus family, I always had the fear, the morbid fear, that the exploding clown car would come back to haunt me. So, I mean, you know, court cases are normally not that entertaining, as my litigating friends would tell you. But that was an extraordinary moment, and I think a career moment.
Harks back to the old story that he ran away from the circus to become an accountant.
For a man that used to be referred to as the grey man, anything but. But I think that's going to be fascinating to watch. And the Scots angle to the case is really interesting too, because the Scots court found, contrary to what the UK High Court said, but they were very clear in their judgment to say that they were finding it on a common law issue. This is a legal technicality, but they were not finding it on a Scots law issue. They felt that it was an overstep of power, and that was something that Gina Miller's counsel kept on emphasising.
Right.
My money is on him losing that case on Monday or Tuesday, but I also said that Hillary Clinton will win the US general election.
I know. we've all got a lot of things wrong. There was another bit when we were talking about the delicacy of these negotiations, and you know, with a lot at stake, there was the Sindo, page 2, warning to Cabinet over Brexit leaks. John, you had a look at that.
Yeah, that's Hugh O'Connell writing in the Sunday Independent. A lot of stuff coming out of Cabinet, and
Simon Coveney quite distressed that he comes in to tell cabinet colleagues that, you know, the score on Brexit, and then he finds it makes its way into the papers. One particularly high profile thing was the level of worry and distress expressed by element of shock expressed by some ministers when they heard the full extent of the consequences of no deal and borders and all of that. So a bit of big stick being put out there with Charlie Flanagan, the Minister for Justice, reminding his colleagues around the table that it's in fact a crime to breach cabinet confidentiality.
Yeah, it's been done quite a lot, though.
Well, should we know nothing if they didn't talk?
Never mind the law. But how significant is this in terms of our current timing? Like, there's a clock ticking.
Well, it's a sidebar, really. I mean, it's 39 days away. We're getting echoes back from Brussels today. The so-called non-papers, which were tabled on Thursday night by the Prime Minister in Brussels, apparently they're not flying, which I suppose ties in with what Noel was just saying there, that we're not going to see movement this coming week either.
Before the Conservative Party convention.
Well, that's part of it. Yeah.
Could I just ask John a question? Just based on something Noel said there, if a fudge has been worked out, we'll say, on one side of this debate, do you think at the moment, if it comes down to it, is our side capable of adapting to a fudge?
I was actually going to ask that of Noel. If he has suggested the shape of a fudge, which would be a kind of a
good idea.
A Northern Ireland only backstop. Yes. We're called something else because we must banish the word backstop.
We'd all have to give a bit of ground.
But can Dublin live with that?
And I would add some degree of assurance to the unionists. I've often thought, for instance, if the EU beefed up somewhat the stuff in the preamble to the May agreement about support for the decisions of the majority in Ireland, in Northern Ireland, all that sort of thing, beef it up, sort of almost bring in the EU as a kind of co-guarantor, some kind of reassurance to the unionists. But it seems to me that the bones of what, I repeat, I have no inside knowledge. Okay. I'm only speculating like anyone round the table, and your guess is as good as mine. But my hunch is that Johnson wants a deal, and that the deal will be shaped quite like the May Northern Ireland only one, the initial backstop, later one with the customs union, and that there will have to be some reassurance to the unionists, and that there will be some degree of give on our side, some things that we'll have to accept, and that might be the test for us. But I think the broad thing will have to meet the test I was talking about earlier of the underlying issue in the whole thing is an ease about identity in Northern Ireland, which was the way of resolving conflict in the Good Friday Agreement, with the idea you could be British or Irish or both. And part of that, not spelled out exactly, some of it was spelled out, but not in detail, as ease of across the border so that it begins to matter less. Yes. And we can settle down and accept the provisions of the Good Friday Agreement, which will be that there'll be unity only if it's agreed north and south, and it would have to be worked out and agreed and not done by a sudden border poll which gives you 50% plus one. That's not the way forward.
50% plus one.
We need a degree of generosity after the long history in Ireland, which brings unionists along with it. And I think that this is a way we could do it.
And an element of selling that backstop that's not a backstop, you would probably see a time limit to it. So they will say within 2 to 3 years and that we will work out a trade deal. With the proviso that a trade deal would be worked out. I mean, look, this is the way you're going to have to sell it.
Yeah, exactly. And it makes perfect sense. Yeah. We were starting to get into very one-dimensional type thinking and forgetting that the Good Friday Agreement was worked out with this kind of mentality of adjustments, fudges, sensitive nuances about identity, and then we seem to throw that out to these polarised approaches. And I think, taking what Noel says, it was totally unhelpful when people started to jump on bandwagons and talk about unity and polls, but I certainly didn't expect it of the government of the day. And I think what one of the unintended consequences of that was, the DUP had their stance and were playing politics, And a lot of moderate and various types of unionists, both in agriculture and business, didn't want to see Northern Ireland, you know, come out of the arrangements, as it were, but felt that they had to retrench and pull back or they would be seen as less than unionist.
Yeah, and that just speaks volumes about the polarised nature of politics in the North and how people have kind of been pushed into those silos over the years, and particularly in recent years. And it's such a pity to see how that has happened,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And I think there's going to be a great... They're going to have... The Irish government are going to have to pull themselves back in terms of gloating, if you like, if there is some
what
sort
a bad
of
idea.
Just, you know, this is when you need to show a bit of maturity, keep your mouth closed, and even if you are in the arms of an election coming down the tracks, and how hard will it be to resist right. that temptation? But they seriously will have to do that.
Yeah, people have to grow up and use common sense on that, or diplomacy maybe is a better word. I'm going to move on very briefly to the public services card, which kind of rambles on and on and on, and some people are very exercised about it and others not so. Jean, tax on public service card, Sunday Times, page 1.
I don't have that article in front of me, but yeah, the public services card story rumbles on and on. In fact, it is only beginning, I think. And sorry, I'm just to, public services card. There is a kind of a doubling down, really, by the Department of Social Protection and possibly other government departments in relation to its approach. What happened this week in the story of the public services card is that this beautiful 187-page or 172-page report was finally published. First of all, the report was not initially going to be released, and there were some FOI requests, which apparently on Monday, as recently as Monday, the government Department of Social Protection was saying we can't possibly release this report because it'll reduce the inability of the state to manage its finances. So really, they really were saying the sky was going to fall down, and then on Wednesday evening was released. So there are a number of findings in the report, and then there's this rather extraordinary statement from the Department of Social Protection, I believe it is, or from the government generally, which kind of battles the report. So where we are now is that it seems likely that the DPC, the regulator in this area, is going to issue an enforcement order. The the relevant government department, Department of Social Protection, has indicated that it may appeal that order.
Yes.
So we're going to the Circuit Court, first of all, probably an appeal on a point of law from that to the High Court. Almost inevitably, for my money, we'll end up in the CJEU. For my money, I don't think in Strasbourg.
Yeah.
And both parties are funded by the state. So both the Department of Social Protection, deeper if it becomes involved, and Department and the DPC itself are state-funded litigation parties.
Data protection.
So we're all going to be paying for this exploration of the legal issues involved. But it's a very unusual story. It's an unfortunate position for Ireland to be in, that our government is having such a kind of a head-on collision with the regulator.
It's also going to undermine the regulator, will it not, in terms of dealing with the Facebooks and the Googles.
Absolutely.
And all
really
of those big
our
monsters.
Credibility on the line in a highly risky way. And there's a really good piece from Owen O'Dell in the Business Post, I believe it is, and it's called Dealing from the Bottom of the Deck on the Public Services Card. It certainly pulls no punches. And one of the lines he says there, that it's a good thing that the Commission is demonstrating its independence in the way that it is, but it's not a good thing that it has had to do so. And I think that's probably one of the best lines you'll see.
Well, you see, they don't agree with her. They don't agree with her, and they got different legal advice. John, what's your...
I continue to be puzzled by this mandatory, what was the word again? Mandatory but not compulsory. And I mean, I don't have big brother hang-ups about this, you know? I mean, and I think I take the view that in a small country, you sit by the phone, you can find out a heck of a lot about your neighbour or anyone else you want for the price of a couple of phone calls. It seems to have been very badly handled by the government. I was actually going to get one of these. I never got around to it. It's like another one of these neglected administrative areas of my life. But it seems to have been very badly handled by the authorities. I guess.
Yeah, what strikes one, if you see, I've said it before, you see people of all ages in France, in Italy, which I would know more than any other countries, They were going around with identity cards all the time.
With a statutory footing having been debated in their parliament, that's the point. I suppose we never had that here. And I think what we're seeing now, and it's difficult from a privacy law perspective, it's what I do for a living, it's very hard to put architecture on something after the fact. And I think what has happened is a decision was made to issue it, and the architecture is trying to be put in place afterwards.
Right. And do you go with the argument that it is an identity card by the back door?
Personally, yes, I do think that's what the intention is. And actually, one of the stories that came out just late last night, actually after midnight on the Journal, was a story indicating that some senior public servants had called, and again, this came out through FOI, had called for the medical card to be replaced with the public service card. Now, we don't know if that, you know, if there's kind of substance behind it or not, but it certainly seems to be. But I think to me, the interesting angle on this story in the last week is you've started to see a divergence in government departments on their approach on this.
Right.
And I think it's because they realise that they individually have risk on it, and saying that the Department of Social Protection or DEEPR told you to do it is not going to be a defence.
I think it's that they're very lucky that Brexit is happening, because if it wasn't, this is the sort of thing that could actually bring the whole thing down.
Yes, I think so.
Okay. On that rather dramatic note, I'm going to take a break, or we'll never get around to what's happening next week. We'll take the break.
Podcast The Marian Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.